everybody, and welcome to the Power Hour. Hello, happy Saturday to you. I have to tell you, I recorded this. Yes, I did. I recorded it on Wednesday because I am probably on an airplane somewhere between Miami and Phoenix, probably, and I try to come in to the show, but I've never been successful doing that on Wi-Fi on the airline. So I did make this presentation because I really thought it was a good one to do. And the next one, I don't want to cancel it or move this one because the very next Power Hour is going to be the 200th. That means we've done 200 Power Hours. Wow, that's a lot. That's 4 years of them, right? About 4 years. So people ask all the time, like, where do you get them? You can actually see them, all 200 if you want to. It's on our membership site. So you got to go to CFIbootcamp.com. And at the top, there's a tab that says Resources. And if you scroll down there, you'll find Bootcamp Plus. And then you can join our membership site. I forgot how much it was, but it's not painfully expensive. And you'll see all those along with other things we put in there. That's the only way to do it. You can see the outlines. You can get all the outlines, and you can get a minute, like a takeaway from each of the show by going to our website, cfibootcamp.com. Going to Resources again and then clicking PH Outlines, Power Hour Outlines. You'll get an, like this presentation, for example, that I'm going to show you right now. It's going to be available in the Resources section of that Power Hour Outlines, okay? So that's what we got going, and we're going to talk about teaching commercial maneuvers today. That's what we're on about. I'm going to be in Palo Alto, California this Monday until, so that's the 2nd of September, Labor Day, until the 11th. I come back on the 11th, and I have a CFI class followed right by a CFAA class. So that's what's going on, and we're getting ready for our October class here in Miami, and then we have one coming up in Las Vegas in November, and then it starts rounding out for the year. We already laid out all the Power Hours for the year, so that's interesting. We didn't publish those, but we'll publish them as we go. We're going to do FAT for wings credit. So, for example, we're going to give those a month in advance to FAA. So if we need to change something, you know, it's pretty easy to do, not the whole year. If you want wings credit for this show, go to the chat. Okay, go to the chat, and Nick will have put in a link in there for a bunch of things. One of those things is for wings credit. Now, it's going to take you to a place where you got to put in your email address, okay? And then there are two little gray boxes you have to tick. Those aren't there because we want to steal your email. Those are there because we're mandated by law to comply with the European regulations. That's the first one. The second one is by our U.S. law to make sure you really, really, really wanted to get what we sent you, right? So for Wings Credit, we don't have another way to collect the data outside of putting it in the chat. And if I have to, like, get 45 different emails in the chat, I'm just probably not going to do it, right? We don't make any money doing it, so I don't want to just do it, right? So, but if you put it in that autoresponder like that, then it's a real easy process for it. It produces a little, like, a Excel file, and we can upload those things quite easily. All right, so anyway, enough of me complaining. Let's get on with what we're going to talk about, because I think I have a lot to say here. Let's look at it. Let's get on it. So this is advanced knowledge of the commercial maneuvers. It's the hows and the whys. This is Power Hour 199. Yay. We're going to do deep dives into the following. Steep spirals, chandelles, lazy eights, and my favorite, eights on pylons. All right, so we're going to talk about those in detail. We're going to show you some errors in the handbook. We're going to show you some things not to do, things to do. So I think you'll have a better appreciation of these maneuvers and in particular technique. And there are some things over the years that just weren't carried forward and kind of were lost in the old handbooks. And so I've taken some of that and put in here too because I think those things are very helpful. So we'll just start here in a second. So basically what's right and what's wrong. So the images in the handbooks aren't quite right. So in fact, all the ground reference maneuvers that are in there are almost all wrong. They're not wrong. They just don't show the airplane crabbing when there's wind. They just show it on the ground track, which is not going to be the case. The nose of the airplane, tip to tail, longitudinal axis, is not going to be on the ground track when there's wind. So every image shows that. There's other things not quite right, too. And each as we approach the images and show them to you from the handbook, I'll show you what's wrong with them. We're going to cover descriptions of how to perform the maneuvers, and they're they're mostly right in that text part of it. The descriptions of how to perform the maneuvers are mostly right. There are just some missing pieces, I think, that were left out that didn't get carried through over the years. So we'll take a look at those. It's on pylons is the first thing we're going to cover. So that's going to be a deep dive because this is one of my specialty maneuvers. I don't know how many people there are that know more about this maneuver than I know about it. I'm sure someone knows a little bit more about it, but in terms of the mathematics behind it, the geometry, the reason it came into being, where it was developed, where you can see the airplane that was used in a movie called The End of the Spear, which demonstrated this idea of using pivotal altitude to collect things from a field on a bucket, on a string, you know, a rope, I should say. So that's Rex Scholl, who's one of the admins for CFI study group, Facebook group. And you should join that, by the way. Dorothy Schick there, and he run this amazing help site for CFIs in training. I think there's a link, probably Nick or Wendell may be able to put it in the chat there, but it's called CFI Study Group on Facebook. About 6,000 members. They meet on Tuesdays live on Zoom for 2 hours. I was just there yesterday, and we're having a really good conversation about a lot of things. We have an FAA inspector comes on. There's a lot of people in there. Scott Finney is there. He's a really good he gives mock check rides. We're going to have him on as a guest here shortly. But anyway, join that. But the point here is he knows where that airplane is hanging in a hangar up on the rafters. It's hanging down. It's not in a museum, but it's in someone's hangar, and he found it. So if he's around, he'll put it in the chat and tell you where you can find that thing. I've forgotten where it's at, but that's something I didn't know. Okay, now let's talk about this idea of eight-zone pylons. At a particular altitude for a given ground speed, if you drop what's called your line of sight, so if you were to look out of the airplane, bank, start a turn, and drop from your shoulder 90 degrees to whatever the longitudinal axis of the airplane down to the ground, aligned with the angle of the wing. So basically, you take if the best way to do it to describe it is to say, if you have a wing there, and you drop this down on a bank, right, and you take your eye and you take it 90 degrees to where your longitudinal axis is, and sort of to the wing, that's the point that's going to pivot if you've done it right. So it'll look like that point is remaining stationary on the ground. It looks like it's just everything is pivoting around that. And that only happens at one ground speed and at one altitude for any given ground speed. We'll see here why in a second. A lot of reasons are the whys of things are the interesting things, right? And do you need to know it to be able to do eight-zone pylons? No. But it's a fascinating maneuver, and why it happens is kind of one of the reasons I really like this maneuver. So the question is that isn't answered here is why does it do that? And it's a little bit about geometry, right? So that's what it's about. And this is actually from a YouTube video that a student of mine made. His name is Mark Spitzer. You can go look for it. He's the guy who developed the Ocular for Google Glass, that transparent lens that would display things. Glass never took off, but he got bought out by Google, and he lived in the Bay Area. He's from Boston area, has a Malibu, and so he's also has a PhD in physics, and he was my CFI student, and a really nice guy. And so anyway, he did this video with no math about this. I already know this, but I thought it was nicely done, and I didn't want to recreate all these images, and I didn't think he'd mind if I stole it. There you go, Mark. I'll give you full credit, though. I don't think you care, but just this for images, right? But you can watch the video. It's kind of interestingly, nicely done. All right, so when you look and you're at a given speed, you're going to make a particular radius, right? So at a particular bank angle and speed, you're going to make a particular radius. And if you look at the wings of this airplane, it maps out what is a cone, right? So if you drop your line of sight, if your line of sight is on directly at the same angle as those wings to a point on the ground, you're basically flying on a cone, the top of a cone, right? That's the first point to get through. So if you're on the cone itself and the apex of the cone, if you're at the right altitude and the apex, the point of the cone, touches the pylon, you are at the pivotal altitude and that point will pivot. Right, as you go around it, that point will pivot because the apex of this cone is touching that point. If it's not touching that point, meaning you're too high or too low, you're going to make a circle around that point. You're not going to get it to pivot. So if you're too low, the apex of the cone is below the Earth, and you're going to make a circle because there's your gaze point. If you look at the wings, how they're banked over, that's your line of sight. It's not on the pylon anymore, and what it's going to do is it's going to make a circle, right, like that. And if you're too high, then the apex of the cone goes the other way, and your gaze point is going to be on the other side of the pylon. And in one of the directions, it's going to look like the wing is moving forward across the pylon or around the pylon in a circle. And the other one, it'll look like the wing is dragging behind it. It'll look like it's making a circle behind. Now, you can do this for fun. I recommend that you do it. Go out, and you know what the pivotal altitude is. It's the ground speed square over 11.3 for in knots. And we can talk all day about why that's true. I have the mathematics done for that, but that's a separate conversation. I've already done a power hour on that, by the way. But the idea here is that for this altitude, if you go out and you look at your AGL height, whatever that is, and you add the pivotal altitude height to it plus a little bit, you'll be above pivotal altitude. And when you start a turn, you pick a point, drop your line of sight, pick a point on the ground, and what's going to happen is as you make that turn, it's going to look like the wing or your line of sight is starting to move backwards across the ground in a circle around that point. It will not stay on the point, but it will make it look like the ground is moving or your wing is moving backwards across the ground. And if you continue to descend, all of a sudden it will stop. That's where the pivotal altitude is. And if you go below pivotal altitude, it'll look like the wing is going forward across the ground, not backwards anymore. And that's now you're too low. So in those cases, you would make the corrections, which if you're too high, you, of course, would pitch down, and if you're too low, then you'd pitch up. So that's the kind of idea here is to fly on the top of this cone. And in this particular case, these airplanes are at different speeds. So the airplane 1 and 2. So airplane 1 is at a faster speed, so it's going to have a bigger radius. And airplane 2 is a smaller radius. And you can if you could envision this, if I go back to here, airplane 1 is right where this airplane is. Airplane 2 is below it. So it would still be at the correct pivotal altitude if it were sliding down this cone and making a new radius. If it keeps the same radius, then it's too high, right, or too low. But if you slide down this cone, anywhere on this cone, and you go around it at the right speed, the apex of the cone will be on the ground, right? And so it will pivot again. So as you go slower, you have to lower the pivotal altitude to remain on that cone, okay? That's kind of an important little concept. Okay. So then, there's the example of that. So there's the first airplane is flying faster. It's got a higher radius at the top of the cone. And if there were a faster airplane yet, it would make a bigger radius, and the cone would just be extended. And there's a slower one. So that's how it works. Here's the pivotal altitude formula. It's a ground speed square over 11.3. It is only necessary, however, to calculate the highest pivotal altitude. You don't need the lowest. Why not the lowest too? You say, because people will say, I teach it wrong. If you hear instructors who... I call it fly on opinion, who don't really ever consult the handbooks. They just fly on what they were told. And then they have epiphanies about things I have a unique way of explaining this or that or whatever it is. A lot of it's wrong. Just dead wrong. So not all the time. Not all the time, but in many times. So one instructor will say you will fly from the highest pivotal altitude you calculate, which is going to be the ground speed. So it'll be your true speed of your airplane plus the tailwind that you're going to have when you're downwind. But you will not need to fly all the way down to where your true speed and the headwind then make the speed slowest. That altitude you will not get to. Ah, you didn't know that, did you? You're like, what? Okay, let me take some of those. So I just finished 3 miles out in the hot sun here in Miami Beach, and I go down to the beach almost every day for exercise, so there I do that. Okay, so look, here's pivotal altitude, this example. 90 knots is what the true speed is. And we have a 20-knot wind. So therefore, we're going to have on the downwind, we're going to have 110 knots. And that works out to, which is the ground speed. So that works out to a tailwind of 20, which is pivotal altitude to 1,071. We're definitely going to have to start there. And then if we look at the headwind side, and we turn directly into the headwind, we would have a ground speed of 90 minus 20, right? So 70. That'd be 434 feet. This maneuver wouldn't be possible to do if we had to fly between those two altitudes, really. It would be a bit of a challenge if we had a lot of horsepower, big motor, we might be able to do it to gain altitude really quickly, but in general, we're not going to. But we don't need to, and here's why. The reason is because You would only need to fly between these two altitudes if you maintain the same indicated airspeed, if you kept 90. But in this maneuver, we don't keep the same indicated airspeed. We allow that to vary. So that's why it works. So here, indicated airspeed is allowed to vary during this maneuver. So if you're too high, then you got to pitch forward to catch the pylon. And then if you pitch forward, then what happens is you'll descend, and that's what you want because you're too high for pivotal altitude. But what happens else is the airspeed increases because you're not touching the power in this maneuver. So the airspeed is not going to be 90 anymore. It's going to go higher. And that's going to do what? That's going to raise the pivotal altitude. By the formula, that's going to raise it. So the fact that you're descending and the fact that pivotal altitude is rising is a doubling effect. And therefore, you can fly this maneuver with very small altitude changes, not big abrupt altitude changes. You can fly it with two fingers, with the fingertips, right? That's how much control you can have over it if you detect the change and you make it quickly. And this is why. So a lot of people, they don't know that, but that's the reason. Okay, so let's move on down here, the list. So if you're too low, you pitch up, okay? So that's going to increase the altitude. That's what you want because you're too low. But the airspeed, indicated airspeed, is going to go down, which is going to do what? It's going to lower pivotal altitude. So the doubling effect works on that. So you're not going to have to fly all the way down to where you'd have a 70-knot ground speed because you're going to let the airspeed vary. That's why, okay? There you go. It's referred to as a doubling effect. It's also the reason that only small changes in altitude need to be made. Now we're going to take a break here in about 10 minutes. Go through a few things. We don't need to take a big break. I can't go through the room and see who's here, but I can say a few things about some things we're working on. All right, so this is a diagram for 8-zone pylons, and it's wrong, right? Dead wrong. It's not right. It looks kind of like this, but let's look at what's wrong with it. The first thing is the angles between the pylons are too shallow. This is about a 20, maybe 25-degree angle between pylons. That's too shallow. It'd take you a long time to get around the pylons. The time in between would be very long. So that angle needs to be about 45 degrees, somewhere around that. The pylons need to be spaced a lot closer than that. And in addition to that, here's the other thing that happens. If you're doing this maneuver right, you're going to start being on the pylon. The wing line of sight will be on the pylon right where my new red line is, not there. That's too late. And you're going to leave the pylon about here. So that's a big bunch of space that you're going to be going around this pylon that's not being counted for. And so if you had to go from here and then had to go all the way down to here, it says 3 to 5 seconds. I think that'd take like 55 seconds. It'd take too long. So that's not right. So this where I have the red lines is where it's correct. Okay? So there's that. Also, the pattern across the ground is not correct. It shows a constant radius pretty much. Maybe it does. Maybe I'm a little wrong there. But actually, it's not going to be a constant radius because you cannot correct for wind during 8-zone pylons except for in between the pylons. While you're turning, you can't correct for wind. If you do, you're not doing 8-zone pylons anymore. You're doing turns around a point. And then, of course, you should know that your line of sight is going to change. So if you try to crab by banking more to keep the radius the same, you're line of sight is going to change. So you're not going to be able to keep pivotal out. You're not going to keep that point pivoting anyway. So you let it drift. That's the whole idea. You let it drift. So now, in this case, they have wind in this diagram, which is why I say it's mostly incorrect. There's no correction for wind is made while turning, right? That we don't make any corrections for that. If you try to correct for wind, your line of sight will change. So the real ground track looks something like this. I wrote this. I found after I made these images, sort of these cartoon images here, I found an image from the old flying handbook that says as much. And there's some things that are missing here that we don't talk about anymore. So I'm going to bring those out to you as we go here. So the ground track's going to look more like that because if you look at this airplane, it's starting out in the middle. It's going to continue to drift with the wind until we get right where this airplane is here, but it'll be over in this where the red line is, where next to it, farther, right? A beam when you're a beam the pylon. I'll show it to you a little bit better here in a second. So that's you're going to be farthest away from the pylon there. And then the other thing is not shown is that when you on the upwind directly into the wind where you're farthest away from the pylon because you're not drifting anymore now. That's drift has stopped. Because you're not taking into account for wind, normally you would have a very shallow bank here, right? So you could keep the radius the same. But because we're not doing that, and we want to keep the wing, the line of sight on the pylon, because remember, if we try to crab by banking, the line of sight is going to change. So we don't want that. So what we do is we have to make a steep turn here at the very top of the pylon. That's our steepest turn, because if it's not steep, we're going to lose the pylon. We're going to fly over it, or we're going to lose our line of sight to it, right? So that's what happens there. You're farthest from the pylon when you're no longer drifting, which is where these red circles are, right? And your steepest bank is going to be at the top. I don't know why this other red circle persisted, but here at the top, that's going to be the steepest bank. And because no correction for drift is done while turning, a steep turn is going to be required to not get blown across the pylon when you're up there basically on the crosswind. Here's that old image from the 1965 flight training handbook, and it says as much. It tells you the steepest bank will be here, and you'll be farthest away from the pylon here. And this is a little better represented as to how it looks. It's, to me, it's a little not I'd like to exaggerate it a little bit, but it's better than the other one, okay? And you can see it exiting the pylon, not here, but over here. And the entry is still a little bit wrong. It depends on how much you're crabbing. But anyway, it's showing mostly what I've said. Okay, that's it for 8 Sun Pylons. How'd you like that? Did that fry your brain? That'll blow your damn mind, they say in the South. Right? Damn, that'll blow your damn mind. All right, there's that. We're going to look at steep spirals. Steep spirals is an interesting maneuver. They say in the South, that's interesting as hell. So steep spirals is a maneuver that's been around for a long time. If you really want to know how to do most of these maneuvers right, because there's a few errors, well, more than a few, but in the 1965 flight training handbook, you can find it pretty easily, PDF version. The steep spiral was originally designed to train out vertigo from you. Ha, how'd you like that? Didn't know that, did you? Maybe, if you listen to other power hours. It was designed to be more than 10 turns. Because they basically said in 3, 4, 5 turns, people don't get vertigo. But after about 10, they start getting it. And so if we can train this out of them, then we have some advantage here, right? So the first thing was not to worry about a point on the ground or whatever. It was just to do 10, 13, 15 turns and roll out on a heading and see how it all went, right? Like, whoo, I got light in the head, right? Okay, then the other was the speed. The speed was done. Are you ready? Not at best glide. It was done at 1.3 to 1.4 VSO. Why? Because you're going to be banking. Now, some people say this, and they're wrong, all right? So they say there's no load factor as long as you're not maintaining level flight. That's not true. It's somewhat true. If it's only true if you let the airspeed continue to increase. If the airspeed's continuing to increase, you're lowering the pitch attitude, you're right. There's no load factor. But if you're stopping the descent by controlling the airspeed, you're going to have load factor. It's not going to be as much as level for sure, but it's going to be something. So the steeper the bank and the more you control the speed, the more of it you're going to have. So the idea here is that at 1.3, 1.4 VSO, you're close enough to the stall speed that it becomes an issue. And the idea here was to train out or avoid accelerated stalls, right, and recognize that. So, and then after that was done, then they put the ground reference into it and said, okay, now you've got to keep a fixed distance around that point. And then it was entered upwind. This image is wrong. This image shows the maneuver being entered crosswind. It's not entered crosswind. It's entered upwind. So what's the only ground reference maneuver that is? All of the other ones entered downwind. So the question is, you'll see in the slides here in a second, but why is that true? Well, think about this. What's the maximum bank angle you're allowed to use for private pilot for turns around a point, rectangular courses, rest turns across the road? The answer is 45. It's in the ACS. So, and also here in the handbooks. So if you enter upwind and you say, I want to maintain a half mile, the wind's super strong, and you end up having to hold like 30 degrees on the first turn to keep the distance, you may then end up with an 80 degree turn on the downwind because you keep, it's not possible to maintain a half mile at 45 degrees. But if you enter the maneuver downwind and your first turn is the fastest, that's where your ground speed is the fastest. That's where the bank angle is the steepest. So if you get to 45 and you see you're drifting away from the pylon and you're not able to hold a half mile, it's going to be three-quarter mile. Well, then it's going to be three-quarter mile. And all the other turns from then on out will be less than 45 degrees, right? So it constrains the bank angle. All right, for this maneuver, this is not the same. So this maneuver is entered upwind, and there's a reason for it. And that's because after you complete a series of spirals, you should be in a position where you can land on the runway straight ahead of you. So you want to be on the upwind when you exit the maneuver so you're in a place to make a landing. So, or if you're too high, you can make a modified pattern. That's the idea. You'll see that in the 1965 flight training handbook as well. So that's the idea of that. Now let's step through it here a little bit so we can do more. Some information is lost, not mentioned anymore, that I'm going to cover here. So we talked about this. In the beginning, it was over 10 turns. After no vertigo, we said the ground reference maneuver is introduced. Also, the maneuver started upwind. So we said that. And we can use bank angles up to 60 degrees in the steep spiral. That's because it was supposed to be landed from. So you should be on a straight into a runway when you're finished with it. Okay, that's what that's for. Now, airspeed is the first parameter to go out of standard in this maneuver. If you're going to do this, you'll find the ground reference is one thing. You can play around with that, but the airspeed will go in a heartbeat. And that's because as the bank angle varies, the pitch attitude needs to vary, right? So why is that? It's not talked about. They just make that statement. Like, oh, it's a great statement. Can we talk a little bit about why? So we will. So originally the speed was, we said, 1.3 to 1.4 VSO for accelerated stall avoidance. Now we use a glide speed, usually a best glide. So as the bank angle increases, airspeed is lost due to induced drag. So when you increase the bank angle, you have more induced drag and the airspeed is going to lower. So you have to lower the nose to maintain the same airspeed. And consequently, as the bank decreases, the airspeed increases. So you have to raise the nose. So that's lost. That's in the airplane flying handbook two times ago. So not the B model, but the A model. And it's other places as well. But it's not in our current one. Now, why? Don't ask me. I don't know. Now, the point that you're spiraling over, depending on your altitude, but usually you have to do this at a pretty high altitude. You've got to finish it by 1,500 AGL. So typically 4,000 or so feet, 5,000 feet. You're doing three turns in this maneuver, at least three turns, it says. You lose quite a bit of altitude. And if you pick a pylon that looks to be like out half a wing strut, that's a lot of miles. So you're not ever going to get a steep spiral around that because that's a lot of ground. But as you get closer to the ground, of course, the ground magnifies and you'd see it then. So you need to pick a point that's like racing almost between the tire, if it's a 172, and the fuselage. Right in there is about where it's at, or on the tire, very close to that. That's what it has to be in order to get this to work out. Okay, let's take a quick break. I want to get you updated on what we're doing and what I'm doing and all this stuff. We are in the process of updating a lot of stuff. Those updates are taking a lot of time and a lot of money. So that's just to tell you that. So, for example, I finished we had to do a weather theory now for – we have to teach weather theory as part of the CFI course because it's in the ACS. So I had to create a presentation on that, a lesson plan on that. And then also there's a second section on charts, forecasts, those kind of products, basically weather products. And there's a third one in that section, which is on flight displays and weather in the cockpit. So I had to make all those things. Okay, so how long do you think that takes? I could put images in there. I want you to just think about that. So each of those, the weather theory presentation took me 9 hours to make because I also have to make it succinct. I have to make it concise. Now, I don't just put sentences on a page, right? I can't do that, right? You wouldn't have nothing out of it. You'll read that while I'm talking to you. So that's not what I want you to do. So the weather theory has to be encapsulized into statements, right? Each slide has a statement, and that's what I talk about. So, and then I may have to make a lesson plan from that as well. So those take. So that whole process, all those lesson plans, and the three lesson plans and the PowerPoints took me. And I'm an expert at this, right? I am a subject matter expert, a SME, right? That took me around 11 hours to do, right? So if you make your own lesson plans, you know, God help you. Great. Good on you if you want to do it right. But there you go. So a lot of time goes into this. Also, we are redoing. It should be done. Well, everything will be done here shortly. But we did We have a book we call the Red Book internally. It's endorsements and scenarios. It's on our website. In the shopping cart, you can get it. And it's scenarios, 26, I think, is in there, 26 scenarios about things like soloing a student, sending them more than 25 miles, adding a category of class, changing levels, you know, some recommending a recreational pilot for it. So there's a scenario presented, and then there's a solution. And then after the solution, there's a flow chart which guides you through all the regulations to see how that all works. So you can test your own work. So we redid all the flow charts, we verified, and we modified some, and we added about 6 or 8 new scenarios. So that's what's coming out there. Now, those of you who have the book, and I can't tell you when it's going to be done. These things take incredible amounts of time. Modifying the flow charts took me 2 days, 2 full days, 16 hours to make sure, because I got to go through each one, right? And then Wendell has to place them in the book at the right places, and then the formatters get a hold of that, and they reformat the entire book and place the new content and, you know, make things look pretty, get the page numbers correct, update the table of contents, and then we got to test all that. So there's just a lot to do. We also are adding 16 new videos, or videos, I wouldn't say new. Some of the replacement videos in the online course, one is airspace. There's a new one about the flight instructor ACS. Then there's another one on ACS in general. Then there's the companion guide. There's a video on that, how to use a C-61-65 hotel, the endorsements one. There's a lot of new content. There's student – all the regulations ones are redone. So and those are finished now. I have to mess around with the airspace one a little bit for a little audio issue. But the others are ready to go, and we'll upload those all at once. We'll pick a day, and that's the day they're going to go in. I don't know when, but that's what's going on there. Again, if you want Wings credit for this Power Hour, you need to go to the chat. Now is a good time to do it so it doesn't close out on you. And click on the Wings credit, and then it'll take you to a place where you can put in your email. When you put in your email, then you'll have to tick those two gray boxes, which allow us to capture your email, because we need that to be able to give you the Wings credit. But that's for Europe and for the U.S. We have to satisfy those federal requirements and international requirements. So you've got to tick those boxes, or it won't capture your email. And no, we don't sell your email. All your stuff stays with us. We don't never do that. So we don't. I have a business flight instructor training. I don't have a business in collecting and selling people's emails. Right? That's not my business. So there you go. All right, we got two more here to cover. We got Chandelles and Lazy Eights. Before I forget, one further thing. We are creating the CFI Mastery class, right? And we're going to, I think, change the name of it slightly, but the landing page, everything's built out now. All the syllabus is built out. It's going to be 2 days, okay? I've changed it to 2 days because in the poll that you guys did last week, you indicated that 2 days would be a better time than three. We originally set it for 3 days. So it's going to be longer per day, but you're going to be able to do it on a real weekend. So you'll be able to come in on Saturday, Sunday, or zoom in on Saturday, Sunday, and be able to complete everything. It'll be longer, but you'll be able to finish it on a Saturday, Sunday this way. We're pricing it, I think we're pricing it for $299 or $250, somewhere around that price, okay? That's what it's going to be. We also surveyed that to see that was about where we thought it would be, the price point would be. So we're going to do that. And the first day is going to be using technology, setting up all of your tech to work, right? There's a prerequisite for this, by the way. So I'm almost done with that. It's a small online course, just an hour and something. And it basically have you watch some videos from 4Flight. They're not too long. And videos from Apple about how to use the iPad. It's not from Apple, but from how to use some tips about using the iPad, setting things up. And then we have like a little checklist for you. It's like to make sure you bring, or if you're coming or you're online, that you have your Apple ID and you have your password. So give you plenty of time to get all that stuff. It's a little checklist. So we send that to you ahead of time. So that way we're setting it up for success. So my goal is when you finish this mastery class that you would be able to go back to where you are, if there's a smart TV there, and project from 4Flight, from the iPad, what you want up there, annotate, draw on the screen, virtual whiteboards. You're able to use Zoom to do remote ground sessions, allow others to share their screens. You have all the – do a class, a physical class with more than one people, maybe 10 people in the class, how to set up breakout rooms. There's all that in there. So it's a complete if you're sort of technologically inept, if you go through the setup, the online course that we're going to set up for you, and you come in with that level of preparation, which isn't tremendous. It's just basic stuff. you'll be successful. So we'll be able to help you. And we also, for the remote user, we have another webcam. So we have three webcams in the classroom. One is that we use is the OWL. It goes 360-degree view. Then whoever's talking, it focuses on. If two people, it'll split the screen and watch the two people or up to three people at a time. Then we also have another webcam, which is going to look directly at my screen for things that Zoom does that it doesn't allow you to. You wouldn't see it if I didn't have the third webcam. So that will allow you then to see everything and follow along. And then there's time in that class to practice. Okay, then the second day is going to be all advanced ForeFlight features, going to be flight planning, how to teach, how to sync up cloud drives like Dropbox. What is Dropbox, right? You will know about that then, how to import things if you don't want to do that. And then the other part of the day will be spent learning how to use the syllabus, how to keep the student on pace with the syllabus, and how to give pre-flight briefings. And you'll get copies of all of our pre-flight briefings, so you won't have to make those on your own. Okay, that's that. So that's going to come up, and I think Nick will have maybe have a link here that he can put in the chat if you're interested in that. Now, you can just say you're interested. We're not going to charge your internet credit card that I don't have access to for it, right? Or nothing bad is going to happen. You're not going to get a thing from me like a UPS package has arrived at your door, right? You are not available. We're not going to get those. You know those things. I get those things all the time. All right. So if you want to attend something like that, I think it's going to make you a CFI that people want to get instruction from, because that kind of instruction that we're talking about and showing you is engaging, and it is exciting. It is not stuck in the 1980s. You know, we're not using a green monitor that's about 2 yards long with MS-DOS running on it, right? Now, at the time, that was pretty cool, but, you know, I think we're past that. So, all right, let's move on. Let's talk about chandelles. So a chandelle is this. Now, I didn't necessarily tell you what I think most of you who are interested in this kind of thing know what a chandelle is. But basically, it's a climbing turn, max performance. It's not a Box Canyon turn. That's wrong. It is not that. If you have a Box Canyon, I'll tell you how to turn. That's stick up almost to the vertical and pivot on the tail. Right? So you want to not hit what's in front of you. You don't care about altitude gain, because wherever you just left behind you is, you didn't hit anything there, so you're not going to hit it again if you go the other way. That minimize the turn radius. So basically pitch up, not to the vertical, but steep, and then pivot, you know, a sharp bank angle below, make sure you're not below. You don't care if you lose a bit of altitude right here, because it's not a Box Canyon turn. It is not that. That's a Box Canyon turn. Your kind of turn, this is just a thing. It's basically built for it to teach you timing and coordination. So the first 90 degrees of a chandelle is a constant bank. It's a 180-degree turn. You can see there in the image, where the first 90 degrees is constant bank, 30 degrees, and changing pitch. And then when you get to the 90-degree point, the pitch freezes. You keep the pitch the same, and you roll out of the turn. So the bank is just so that you're just above the stall speed when you get to the 180-degree point. So that's the idea of this. And there are things in here, right, that I can tell you that aren't printed anywhere. This image isn't correct. What's wrong with it? We're back to the idea of the symmetry of the image is what's wrong. So it's not a constant radius like that, because the speed is changing, right? So the turn radius decreases as the speed is lost, so it won't look like this. And when you get to C, when you start turning, that radius is going to continue to shrink. It's going to look like one of those, what do you call that? Like you hang a bulb on a Christmas tree, that hook. Kind of look like that. Start off and it'll come around. It'll get tighter and tighter and tighter. You can bend it in tighter. So it'll look more like that. And then what's the pitch attitude at the 90-degree point? I ask people in our CFI class this, and boy, the answers I get. It's the same answers that I get, the dumbfounded, which is fine. You're allowed to. We don't judge you on this. I mean, I'd like to, but I can't. I can't, because I was worse than you when I started, right? So you ask me a question. Now I ask the good questions, right? You go like, oh, that's a good question. So I ask you this question. One is about the chandelle. That's the question. The other is about when to descend for landing at an airport. So here you are. You're flying along at pick your altitude, 8,000 feet, 3,000 feet. And it's time. You say, okay, now is when I'm going to start letting down for the airport. I can see the airport. When do I let down? Every CFI that I would examine would be able to put their hand on the throttle at the right point and start descending. And I say, now teach me how I would know to descend at that. How would I know that? You know, teach me. I don't know how to do that. You just did it. I saw you do it. Obviously, you know, teach me when it's the right time. And boy, no answer comes. No answer comes. Well, I'm going to tell you. Then we'll go in the last two maneuvers here. Just so I can not leave you hanging, right? So if you're flying along and you're far, far away from the airport and you can see the horizon, the airport is over the horizon. That's too soon, right? And if you watch, the airport's going to come to the horizon. It's going to come towards you. And eventually, if you do nothing, it's going to go below you and then behind you. That's too late. So there must be a point then that you could measure from the horizon to you that is the right angle. And that angle is when the runway is halfway between your cowling or what you're looking at and the horizon. So when it comes off the horizon and comes halfway to you, that's about 3 to 4 degree glide angle. That's what you want. You can control the speed. That's how you know. And you just keep that picture the whole way down to the ground. Right? And if you didn't know that's what you're doing, that's what you're doing, right? You're making the picture look right. What is the right picture? And I mean, not all airplanes, but most airplanes, it's when the runway, the touchdown point comes off the horizon and is about halfway between the horizon and your cowling. Halfway, middle of the windscreen, basically, is about where it's at. Okay, now, so I ask, what's the pitch attitude at 9 degree point for a chandelle? And here's what I get. 15 degrees, 12 degrees, 8.5, 20. I get it, and whatever, right? And so the answer is, you ready for the answer? It's not a good answer, but it's the right answer. It's the pitch attitude at which held will result in you being at the approximate stalling speed at the 180 degree point. And so that means it varies with the airplane. It varies with the altitude. It varies with the horsepower of the engine. It varies with the weight. It varies with a lot. So you could say today it's 12 degrees or 15 degrees, but not every day. What is it in the extra 300? In the extra 300, it's about 45 degree on the upline. That's about what you need to put it on to get the chandelle to work. 45 degrees pitch up. In a J1 or, say, a Ronca Champ, it's about 6, 7, 8 degrees. That's it. Maybe if it's that. It'll run out of juice before it gets there, right? So it depends on the airplane. So that's the first thing to know. But I can tell you this, that this is what's not published. Are you ready? Get your notepad out or get your phone ready. Take a picture. The chandelle, if you do this correctly, the speed is always falling. The speed will never be stuck on any one value. It goes all the way down from where you started, and it goes all the way down to the approximate stalling speed right at the moment you roll the wings level at the 180 degree point if you did it right. The airspeed will never be stationary, which means that if you do this at roughly the same altitude, same weight, same airplane, that and the same pitch attitude, that at the 90-degree point, there must be an airspeed that is the right airspeed for the 90-degree point for this particular airplane. And you can target that speed. So maybe we start off at 95 knots, and then maybe that speed is like 70 in the chandelle. So that helps us because is that we noted it because we did one right. And we said, oh, we did one right. That was 70 right there. And now we have a pitch reference for the 90-degree point. So when we get to the 90-degree point, we can say we should be 70. We're 75. We've got to increase the pitch slightly so we can get on and get slower by the time we get there. Or we've pitched too much. So you can soften the pitch up a little bit. It's not a cheat or a hack, but it's a way to refine the maneuver at the 90-degree point. Okay, so there's that. Moving on, that's what we said. It varies with that. We said that. When is right rudder used less in a chandelle, to the right or to the left? This one is interesting. So when would you use less right rudder? In a chandelle, to the left or to the right? Now you're going to think it's funny. So let's look at it. To the right during rollout. Why? Why would you use less right rudder in the rolling out from a turn to the right? That means you're going to be using left aileron to raise the wing, right? Because the left turning tendency is pull you left. You know that already. That's what you have rudder for. But when you're rolling out of a chandelle to the right, you're actually using left aileron to raise the wing, and that's going to produce adverse yaw. And adverse yaw is going to slow that wing down, and it's actually going to tend to cancel the effects of the left turning tendencies right there. So you need less right rudder because you're inducing adverse yaw opposite to the direction of left turning tendencies. Ooh. That just gets you in the head. I know, that got me in the head when I first heard it. I'm like, I'd say, amazing, we say, amazing. Yeah, what else would we say? That's that. Okay, this is basically what this is saying. And again, you have a copy of this in the outline, so you're getting a copy of this presentation as a PDF, okay? There's that. We talked about that. Okay, that. Okay, then we're on about the last thing we're going to talk about is lazy eights. Yeah, so they say in the South, that'll blow your damn mind right there, right? So I don't know why I'm on the South thing lately, but I am. We do it in class, too. It's never a dull moment or a CFI class. If you've been to them before, you'll know this is not a static class. It's pretty humorous, right, a lot of times. But you have to make it that way. Well, you don't have to, but if you do, people identify with good humor, especially on something highly technical, and then you give it a little break for a second. That's a good thing. We're also doing things differently. I got to tell you why I got a few minutes here. I revamped this course, our CFI class, a lot. So in our CFI class, the first day is spent pretty much using technology all day, getting you up to speed on that, along with some other things. I've also dumbed down the FOI. So what? Yeah. Which means that here's what I've been thinking about. Every other country that makes flight instructors, right, they have either no such thing as the fundamentals instructing, or they have a smaller version of it, like Australia and New Zealand have smaller versions of it. And for good reason. So, because it's this information in the aviation instructor's handbook is too much. It's too difficult to process, right? Then you question, okay, how about that? How am I going to puke it all out during a check ride and all this stuff? So here's what we are doing. Now you're going to think it's crazy, but it's not crazy, but maybe you think it's brilliant, right? Here's what I've decided to do. So I'm going to have you as prerequisite material before you come to our CFI class. You have to, I give you a copy of the 1969 Flight Instructor's Handbook. It's red. And in it, there's 19 pages on the FOI. All of that worked then. It still works today. It's the same things that's in our current FOI, but it's 19 pages rather than 178 or whatever it is pages. And I think that is a skeleton or the framework for the FOI because that was what was important when it was sort of made, birthed, so to speak. And that worked for a lot of years. It kept getting denser and denser as the time went. But if you look at the essence of the FOI, which is what I want you to concentrate on, the essence of it, that'll be contained in the 1969 Flight Instructor Handbook, and you get a copy of that, and you read that, all 19 pages, so that way when we talk about the FOI in context in the class, you can see, okay, you go to the chapter and you say, oh, I read that, I understand that, look at all this fluff that's around it, now we sort out what's important and what's not. We already know, we already have the important stuff captured, because it's only 19 pages, and concepts, right? And then the rest of it is how do we deal with all the other stuff that's surrounding this? Because sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees, right? And so that's a way to constrain the knowledge. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make a more practical application of the FOI. I'm pretty much done lecturing it because the idea of the FOI, I mean, I'm good with concepts, don't get me wrong. But what I'm not good with is each DPE tests this thing differently. One person we have tested all by scenario. He gave you an example, says, make me a small lesson plan on anything you want and assume that I didn't bring my hearing aids today and I'm hard of hearing. Okay? That tests out all of mostly chapter 7, which is planning instructional activity. That tests out a lot of learning theory side if you understand how different learners work. And so there's a lot of those things, say 5-10 of those. That's it. There's no like rote things like what are the characteristics of learning? Reaper, right? The other guy? No. It's all linear. Write it down. What is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? His wife is an educator. She's a middle school teacher. And I said to him, I said, if you give your wife the same test, she will not pass it. But she's an good educator, right? I hope you say yes to that, or I'm going to send her a copy of this, right? So yeah, you know. So what it means is that we'll do our due diligence on the FOI and we'll give concepts, right, and useful things because we're doing a lot of practice in the class with teaching and other sorts of things. So it's coming out anyway. And then we'll prepare for the specific DPE. If you got to memorize stuff, we'll tell you that. If you don't need to memorize stuff, we'll tell you that too. That's kind of how the way, but that frees up a lot of time for us to do more things that are more impactful. Like one of the things we're going to be doing is talking about Rick Stoll's 9 principles of flying a light aircraft, right? And it's broken into three components. We're going to start using that. And using that as part of teaching. So because it really encapsulates a lot of stuff that's important. So and a lot of good technique. Also, David St. George of SAFE, he and his entourage there have been working on things like dispelling some myths about, you know, effective communication, how much information is lost due to this, how much is gained in this particular setting or a different way. And so those things aren't in the Aviation Instructor's Handbook, but they're so relevant because they're all true today. So that's the kind of things I think, in addition to the FOI, we need to be talking about how to make better teachers. That's really what we want. We don't want to just lean on the Aviation Instructor's Handbook as now you've memorized the whole thing, so now you're a good teacher. You're not yet. So, or you might be. We'll see, but we're going to get you there. So let's look at Lazy Eights now. We've got about 5 minutes more, 6 minutes more before we close out, so I wanted to look at this last maneuver for you, and then we can... I won't be able, of course, to open up the room because I'm not there. I'm not here. I'm not in person. I want to be, but I'm not. I'm going to be in person for the next one. That'll be our 200th. That will be in the live class for Palo Alto, CFI class in Palo Alto on Saturday. That's going to be the 8th, right? 2, 3, 4, 5. Yep, that's the 8th. So 8th of September will be the 200th power hour. We don't know what we're doing. We do not know. It's going to be something. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be, but that's a pretty big milestone. Anyway, that's that. Okay, let's move on with this. Lazy Eights. So a Lazy Eight is a maneuver where you're doing a climbing and descending turn, and you're doing two of them that are 180 degrees each. So a climbing and descending turn that are 180 degrees each. You're near the stall speed at the top of the turn at the 90-degree point, and you're back to cruise airspeed, same altitude, an airspeed as you were when you started at the 180. That's kind of the idea. So in this particular maneuver, the flight control pressures are always changing, always. Now, there's a video out there of a person who I know and I respect and I like, and I did many tests for his students. This is Jason Miller from the Finer Points. You know, hey, if you're listening, Jason, you know, you do a great job always, but I do not like your video on the hack. I call it the hack on Lazy Eights. I would... If you listen to it, it probably work. It depends on the airplane, but because of overbanking tendency. But the idea is, then you might as well just take every descriptive piece of text out of the airplane flying handbook about a Lazy Eight because you're not really flying it, right? So I think the purpose of this Lazy Eight is to develop timing, coordination, instinctive feel for the airplane. That's the reason for it. And I think if you just try what he says, it will work. But it will demonstrate the airplane's overbanking tendency. I do agree with that. But it's not. I don't think the intent of the maneuver was to do that. I think the intent was to develop a more polished pilot, not to just demonstrate that the airplane has overbanking tendencies and it can be used to an advantage. Okay, so that's that. But anyway, I'm going to have Jason hopefully on as a guest speaker, and maybe we'll have a little debate about that. It's a nice one because he's a super nice guy. He plays guitar. You know, if you don't know him, he's at West Valley Flying Club there in San Carlos, California, and I've known him for a very, very long time, and good guy. Okay, but I don't like his video. He probably doesn't like shit I said either, or things I swore. Things I've said either, but there you go. Okay, let's move on to this thing. This image is not 100% correct either. It's similar to the Chandel's image where the radius of the turn as you go from B to C to D is going to be decreasing. It's going to look more like an egg, the top of an egg right there, the small end of an egg. It's going to, the radius is going to be decreasing as it gets there. It's not going to be a circle like that. So there you go. Then as the speed decreases, the radius of turn decreases. That's true. The image shows the turn radius mostly the same, which isn't right. This maneuver really resembles a snowboarder in a half pipe. So basically, if you have a visual on that, you know, you have someone going up the ramp on this one side of the pipe. They get slower and slower and slower, and they come to the top. And because the speed is slow, you can make a very small radius turn and come down. If you had the same speed as you did when you went in there, your turn radius would be huge. And off the pipe you'd come, probably. Right? Ooh, there you go. Into the air. I'm flying. I did that on my scooter once. That was not good. I flew at 20 miles an hour. Yeah, I was a pilot, but I didn't have... I must have forgot my pilot certificate at home because it didn't end well. But FA didn't come visit me. Scooter. All right. Here you go. The entry speed is fast, but at the top it's slow, and so you can make a small radius. That's the idea. If you do not get slow enough in this maneuver, it's going to be a challenge. So if the speed isn't slow enough at the 90-degree point, the turn will not be completed to 180 degrees. You'll be too fast. The turn radius will be too great, And by the time you pitch down, the airplane won't come through the turn. So you have to get slow. You got to be 5 to 10 knots, preferably 5, right there at part C, at point C of this. Or if you're not getting around the horn in the Lazy 8, it's probably because of this, okay? Probably because you're not slow enough there. You need visual references for the 45, 90-degree point, 135, and 180. And those need to be on the horizon, nothing close. So look way out of the horizon. Here we use downtown Miami. We use Fort Lauderdale. That's sort of 45 degrees apart. Use a canal way down at the horizon. You want to be able to see those things way out there. For rudder pressure, this is in the handbook, and they say, you know, this is kind of a little tricky to understand, but basically in a turn to the right, you're going to have to overbanking tendency, and that's due part to the speed is being very slow, and the second is you're putting in right rudder, more right rudder to count for the left turning tendencies, so it tends to want to overbank there. And so when you do that, you have to hold a little bit of opposite aileron. Some people, I don't know if you would say they even be conscious of that, but you'll do it instinctively. I just look outside, and whatever I need to do is what I do. I don't really notice if I'm pulling or twisting or whatever. I just know it's what I need to do to get the picture to look right. So they say, okay, that's a bit tricky to understand. So they said, you can remember it this way. Rolling right at low air speeds and high power settings requires the most right rudder. Okay, that's pretty good for rudder pressure. And overbanking tendency requires slight opposite aileron. So if you're rolling right at low air speeds and high power settings, that's where you're going to use the most right rudder in a Lazy 8. And that's going to be in the right turn at point C when you're just coming through the horizon. And by the way, people get that wrong too. The Lazy 8, there's no slicing through the horizon. There's none of that. You're flying it all the way, the whole way through. And you are not, at the 90-degree point, the pitch attitude is level. The airspeed's still decreasing because the nose was slightly above the horizon. And it's not increasing until it goes below the horizon. That'll be your slowest speed, but you're going to be level pitch. The highest pitch will be at point C at 45 degrees. So this maneuver, very easy to screw up. But anyway, there's that. Now, as the speed decreases, the outer wing produces more lift than the inside wing. That's interesting at this point C. And that example. So if you have very low speed, the inside wing will look or be almost stationary across the ground if you can get the speed that slow. But the outside wing is still moving if you're at 30 degrees of bank, causing more lift and overbanking tendency. So you can see that the inside wing really isn't moving much, hardly at all, very slowly compared to the outside wing. So at low speeds, the overbanking tendency will tend to be higher. So the faster your speed, the less this happens. Okay, we're coming up to the end. That's the end of this presentation. I hope you found that useful, and I don't know, we'll catch up again next week. And I will tell you, I'm sad I couldn't see you in person today. I like talking to you. I can't open up the room. Maybe Wendell or someone could do that. I don't mind if someone wants to open it up. All the links for credit and for the things we've talked about today are in the chat. So if you haven't done that, go there and get those links. Click on what you want. If you want to register for the CFI Mastery class for just information, it's there, it should be there. We have a new landing page. You probably get to it, hopefully. I haven't talked to Nick about that. It's Wednesday, so it still has till Saturday to get that going. And that's it for this week, and I will see you next Saturday live and in person in Palo Alto. So that's it, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.